Right, we're starting.
Start again?
No, I'm not going to start again. So I, Richard, I'll do a recap. I, Richard, invented the beginnings of the study of literature by, in his book, Practical Criticism, and in it he laid down what was appropriate, the beginnings of what's appropriate and what's inappropriate when you're doing a reading of a poem. And the example that I've just given is, if you are an atheist or a Buddhist or if you're in Islam, then you do not say of the poem, it's no good because it's Christian. You are supposed to suppress your own private beliefs and enter into imaginative sympathy with the poem. Right. There's the basis. And that basis is formalist because when he gave out the poems for people to read, he not only didn't tell them when they were written, he didn't even tell them who wrote them. So they got At the Round Earth's Imagined Corners, and it didn't have John Donne written underneath it. It was just a poem. In other words, it could have been written yesterday. You could sort of tell that it wasn't, because the language is obviously not the language of the 20th century, or indeed the beliefs. But that would be like an extremely non-historicist way of criticising a poem, of analysing a poem. And to that extent, it's formalist. Okay, next step. I, Richards, has a student called William Empson. William Empson, who was your age, right, was a genius. He was quite extraordinary. In Cambridge then, and I think now, although I don't know, you do one-to-one tutorials. And what you do is you, if you do in English, you write an essay about something or other, and then you come along and you read it to the tutor, and he, and then you discuss it. So Empson turns up with this poem, this essay, in which he's invented a way of looking at a poem, and he did it to a poem and read it to I. Richards, and I. Richards was somewhat mind blown by that, but since he's English, he didn't overreact. He said, "Yes, that's jolly good." He said, "You could develop that, use it to other poems." And Empson said, "Yes, I think you could." So he said, "Well, why? Then you should go away and write some more essays using the same methodology." So Empson, over the period of about 4 weeks, wrote these essays, and they are the substantial basis and most of the content of a book that he published called Seven Types of Ambiguity. And that book is thought by many to be the greatest work of literary criticism written in the 20th century. And he wrote it when he was a student, just like you. Empson was a genius. He got a degree, he got a brilliant degree. He was heading for a brilliant academic career, and he was expelled from the University of Cambridge. This is the personal interest aspect of the story. He was sacked. Why was he sacked? Because in Cambridge you have servants who make your bed. I think they're called bedders or something. And his servant was making his bed and thought it would be a good idea to look in the drawer next to his bed, and looked in this drawer. And what she found so horrified her that she picked it up and took it to the master of the college and made a formal complaint. It was a contraceptive. As a result of this obscene object being found in his room, he was sacked, he was expelled from Cambridge, and his academic career was completely ruined. And what he did was he went to China, got a job teaching in China. That was the only place he could get a job. Taught brilliantly in China, was there up to the outbreak of the Second World War, which was made China a pretty dreadful place to be, came to England, worked in censorship, worked in propaganda in the BBC, and then got an academic job after the war in Sheffield, got a chair in Sheffield, was a great and famous critic. Wrote several other books developing the methodology. What I'm going to tell you is Empson's methodology. Empson's methodology is a formalist methodology, and you can use it. It is very easy to use. What you do is, all right, here's the theory. It's very simple. Any poem, he said, means more than just what it says. Must do. Any poem is capable of multiple readings. If a poem survives and lasts, then it must be read in different ways by different people many times over. Poems have this kind of richness, prose as well, but particularly poems. That is what literariness is. Therefore, if you go through a poem and you underline the words that look potentially interesting, then what you do is you're interested in what meanings they had, multiple meanings they had, when the poem was written. You can find this out because in English we are incredibly lucky because we have a dictionary of the English language which is unique in the world in that it tells you all of the meanings that every word ever had in the whole of the period when English was spoken, with an example, at least one example for each. It's an absolutely incredible work. 14 volumes long, took 70 years to create. What you do, therefore, is you look up the interesting words in the Oxford English Dictionary and you find out what meanings were available at the time that the poet was writing. And in particular, you're interested in what was the head meaning and what are the secondary meanings. And what you write about is the way in which the secondary meanings, they can contradict the head meaning. So the poem can be meaning in two different directions. That's rather like a Freudian analysis. And indeed, Empson was influenced by Freud's interpretation of dreams. That's part of what gave him the idea. Or they can complement each other, or they can modify each other in subtle and interesting ways. And that was Empson's technique. Now, what I recommend you do is I recommend you try this, see if you can work it. I recommend that you read Empson's book, Seven Types of Ambiguity, and you are extremely fortunate because Seven Types of Ambiguity is available free on the internet. And I've put in a link to it on my website. When you read it, ignore the seven different types. Nobody is interested in that. The classification doesn't really work. It's not interesting. What's interesting is Empson's analyses of poems. Just look at the way in which he applies the technique, the analyses. And you don't have to read all of it. Read as much as you want. So what I'm now going to do is to give you an example of Empson at work.
Somewhere. Can I ask a quick question? If you're looking at the meanings of words in at the time the poem was written, does that not become...
Historicist.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the historicists say that Empson is not a historicist.
Okay, so you can use that.
Because it's only about language and meaning. It's not about historical context.
It's the language, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you were going to use it in your essay, would you say, this is Empson's?
You're going to say, you can either just do it, because it's now so common and so universally adopted that it's simply a thing that people do, or you can specifically say, citing Seven Types of Ambiguity, this is the methodology I'm using, and it's based on Empson's formalist technique. Here he goes. So there are two lines by John Donne, and they go like this. Listen, he's addressing a woman, and he says, "O more than moon, draw not up seas to drown me in thy sphere." Right, referring to the way in which the moon moves the tides, draws the sea. Okay, Empson takes just that first line and just those four words, and this is what he says. She is moon because she draws up the tides of weeping, both from him and from herself, a power not necessarily to her credit, but at any rate deserving adoration. The moon, too, is female, inconstant, chaste, because though bright, cold, and has arms in which the new moon holds the old one. Some of the lyrical release in the line may be explained as because it is deifying her and remembering the Sydney tradition, the tradition, the courtly love tradition, even now, after so many faults in her have been implied and are still being implied. She is more than moon because she is more valuable to him than anything in the real world, because she has just been called either the earth or the heavens, and they are larger than the moon, as controlling tides more important or more dangerous than those of the sea, as making the world more hushed and glamorous than does moonlight, as being more inconstant or as being more constant than the moon, as being able to draw tides right up into her own sphere, as shining by her own light, and as being more powerful because closer. Now, that's what this technique you can do with just two words, okay? If you have to be a genius. This gives you something to aim for, right? Okay, that's Empson. Meanwhile, over in Russia, after the Russian Revolution, Russia was a very radical and interesting place to be, and there were theorists there who were studying literature in order to attempt to make it scientific. These people were called, they actually called themselves formalists, they were the Russian formalists. As far as you're concerned, the most interesting question that they asked is, what is it about literature that makes it literary? What is the definition of literariness? And the answer that they came up with, and it's a formal answer, is, it's a very beautiful answer, is literature is that class of writing that makes what it is about strange. Literature makes strange. The word that they used, the Russian word, was ostranenia, which means literally making strange. The more formal translation is defamiliarization. So how does literature defamiliarize? Well, the idea is that when you read a poem, if the poem is good, then what it will do is make the world seem as if you'd never seen it before. A lover, a rose, a tower, a beach, a sunset. It will remind you or recreate for you the experience of seeing these things for the first time. And it will use language to do that in a particular way, and the way in which it does that is it uses metaphor and it uses the formal aspects of language. Literature is about rendering novel that which you're used to. It is about awakening, about taking you out of the tedium of the of normality into an Eden where the world has just been created. Now, that too is a technique that you can use. You can look at a poem and you can look at the metaphoric life of the poem and you can say, look, by describing it in that way, the poet is indeed making it strange. By comparing the experience of being in love with escaping a storm and coming into a port, the poet is making the experience of love strange, new. and you can say, and that's a Russian formalist notion. Okay, so far?
Do we just do one of these approaches?
You can do or one, you can do more than
or you can do you can do a few within formalism, if sorry. You're doing that approach.
Yeah, you just choose. Russian formalists repudiated history. They weren't interested in history, they said it was boring. This was not a great idea in the Russia of Stalin, because communism thinks that history is the most important thing in the world. Okay, that's the basic Marxist theory. Therefore, many Russian formalists were shot, and the others kept quiet or recanted, or moved east. That gave rise to what's called the Prague School, and they carried on the formalist notion, but they were more purely linguistic. And I'm not going to go into their techniques because it is outside my qualification, because I'm not a linguist. It's really quite technical. But if you want to follow it up, their great man was Roman, spelt as in Roman, Jakobsen, J-A-K-O-B-S-E-N.
How would you approach a text in a Russian formalist way if you're reading it? Do you just look for things that present something new?
Yeah. Yeah, the way in which the metaphor revives a conventional notion.
Okay.
See what I mean?
It wouldn't just have to be a metaphor, would it?
No, well, they mainly worked with... they mainly worked with narrative. And I'm not sure how they did that. You're going to have to research it.
Yeah.
Okay. When I was preparing for this, I just hit on this notion of defamiliarisation as the one most appropriate to poetry and most appropriate to the analysis of particular poems, which is what your job is. Jakobsen's definition of poetry is that class of writing which calls attention to the way in which it is written, as opposed to being towards the author or towards the reader. It is actually about the way it's written. In other words, it's in kind of writing where the form is foregrounded, and it does that by meter, by the verse form, and so on. All right, enough of that. The new critics in America, who were also in the business of making literature professional so that it can be taught in university, were influenced by the Russian formalists and influenced by Empson and I.A. Richards. And they developed the notion, which became universally accepted in all the English schools, or all the English departments in America. This is the way to do it. Their idea was that the encounter with poetry is like this. There's the author over there, and that's one place you can look for the meaning. Don't look there. You're not trying to get what the author had in his head when he was writing it, because you cannot know that. Authors are usually dead, and if you ask them, they usually tell lies. You're not trying to get just the words on the page, because unless somebody's reading the words, those words are meaningless. They're just black marks on a bit of paper. You're not trying to get the way in which the poem just affects me, my emotional response, because that's only about you. We don't want to hear about you, we want to hear about the poem. So going for the author, that's the intentional fallacy. Going for just the way it affects me, that's the affective fallacy. What you should therefore do is produce a reading of the words on the page, paying strict attention to the words on the page only. None of that bloody history stuff, which is very boring, we're not interested in it. We're interested in my experience of the poem now, in as much as it can be communicated to and shared with other people. The potentially collaborative experience of the poem. So what you're doing, if you're doing a new critical approach, is you are creating a shareable, enhanced, beautiful meaning of the poem that you can give to others. That is the verbal icon. That is the well-raw term. Not the author, not the page, not me, but something else that you have created in collaboration with all of those, and in potential or actual collaboration with all those who've written about it before and all who've come after it, and all who will come after. And yeah, that's new criticism. And the supreme example of that, Wimsatt is a theorist, and he said, you don't talk of, he dismissed the effective fallacy and dismissed the intentional fallacy in his famous essay. And I knew him. He was 7 feet tall. Very amazing. Whereas Cleanth Brooks, whom I also knew, was 4'6". And every Christmas they used to do this act where they would do a party, and they had those bells, you know, which were different notes, and they would play these bells. Wimsatt and Brooks playing jingle bells on these bells. I have seen this. It's of no relevance whatsoever. Meanwhile, back in France, the serious formalists became structuralists. Structuralists are interested in making, still in the project of making the study of literature scientific. So they look at form, and they want to show, really, they are more formalist than anybody I've mentioned so far, in that they're not really that concerned with content. They want to have an objective way of talking about literature. They worked big time on narrative. So, for instance, prop, P-R-O-P-P. He is interested in finding what are the basic components of a story. What do you need to have a story? So, for instance, is this a story? The king died. No, that's not a story. Okay, what about this? The king died, then the queen died. Ah, maybe that's a story. Because it's starting to have narrative, right? So what you need in a story is you need a hero, you know, you need a main person, you need an action, you need an opposition person. And he drew up a great table of the sort of things that happen in any story as a definition of story. That's structuralism, right? You're looking at the basic structures. That project disintegrated because there is a limit to what you can do with just talking about structure without talking about meaning. So the structuralists all died or became post-structuralists. And post-structuralists are pretty lunatic. And everybody in the English department had a really wonderful time producing the most wild and amazing readings of poetry. Until somebody said, look, come off it. And then they had to stop, which is a shame because that was really nice. And what took over then was at last the historicists get a voice. And they say, everybody up to now is just a bunch of bloody formalists because they ignore history, and you can't ignore history because history is real and true. Therefore, what we should read, how we should read the poem is how it reflects and how it takes part in the historical events of the past. And they were superseded by a bunch of people called the New Historicists. And what they said was, history is only stories, and literature is only stories. You should read literature as one of the stories that make up history, which is a much more subtle version of historicism and quite different from classical historicist, in that classical historicist assumes that history is true, whereas the new historicists don't. They think it's just a story like any other story. Now you know.
Is that when we could do new historicism as a approach, or would you suggest just doing historicism?
You haven't really been taught new historicism.
No, not at all.
If you want to do new historicism, you've got to read Greenblatt. Don't ask me what Greenblatt says, because although I have read some of his stuff, because I'm not a historicist of any description, I'm a Lacanian, right? Which is basically post-structuralist and kind of wild. There you are. And so I don't have to read this tedious history stuff.
So Greenblatt,
he's the guy.
If you were going to do formalism, and like even if you said, "Oh, I'm going to do this approach," then you're obviously referencing that. What other things would you reference? Because you're just talking about your ideas of the meaning, aren't you?
Yeah, but if you do the Emersonian technique, then you cite seven types of ambiguity, and you say, "Here I'm." You know, I'm going to talk about the ambiguities of meaning in this particular line, following Empson. Then I'm going to talk about meter, and that's formalist because it pays attention to the form. And then I'm going to talk about the way in which this particular way of saying it makes it strange and new. Cite Russian formalism.
Okay.
All right. Research it. You've got to research it. This is just a lecture. This is not a truth.
Yeah.
This is a device to get you into the library.
But can you still cite other people's opinions of what it means, or are you just purely saying, like, what you think it means? If there's a critic that says a certain line means a certain thing, can you still cite that?
You cite that, and then ideally you should disagree with it or develop it, because you get more marks. Anybody can cite a critic.
Yeah.
What we're interested in is what you think. But it's good to cite a critic because it gives you somewhere to start from.
Yeah.
Can there be no overlap at all between like the approach that we're choosing? Say, if we're doing formalism, we can't include any historicism or any like.
Yeah, you can, because what you're supposed to do is talk about the impact, remember? Okay, what you do is you say, look, here's this formalist approach and it says this. And that's very good, but look, if you did historicism to this, it would also say that, and the absence of that is a big gap in formalism.